Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Good afternoon, and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar, Adjudication versus Rulemaking, a look at how NLRB sets labor policy. I'm Alex Zenos, Practice Groups Fellow at the Federalist Society. A couple of notes before we begin. As always, the Federalist Society does not take policy positions, and all views expressed in this session belong to our speakers. Time permitting, we'll take questions from the audience, so if you have any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen. Now, I'm pleased to introduce our moderator, Alex McDonald, shareholder and co-chair of the Workplace Policy Institute of Littler Mendelson. Alex advises employers on all aspects of the employment and labor landscape, focusing on emerging legislation and regulation. His extensive experience advising businesses on worker classification, arbitration, the administrative and regulatory process, and the future of work. He's a recognized expert in the field and frequently writes, publishes, and speaks on these subjects. His work has been cited by scholars and appellate courts alike. Alex, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Alex. That's a very generous introduction. We have an all-star panel today, and I'm really excited to get over to them. We have Brian Hayes, who's a former member of the NLRB and now Ogletree, and we have Professor Sam Stryker, who is at NYU, has written extensively on the topic we're going to be discussing today. Later, we'll be joined by Marvin Kaplan, who is also a former member of the NLRB, recently former member, and has also written on these topics. But I'll just take a brief moment to set the stage and, you know, explain why we're talking about rulemaking at the NLRB, which historically is not exactly the legal equivalent of a unicorn, but it's about as close as you can get. So for most of its history, the board hasn't done much rulemaking, at least not on substantive rights afforded to workers by federal law. Instead, it's developed labor policy, which is its statutory mission, mostly through case-by-case adjudication. But that may be changing, and it's why we're talking today. There are a few reasons, and I'll just tick off three that occur to me. One is that the board has recently had trouble making policy in its accustomed way through adjudication for a few reasons. One is that it's for most of 2025, it didn't have a quorum. So the board has a statutory requirement of three members to take any action. It's a five-member agency, and they didn't have three members for most of 2025, so weren't really able to do much of anything. There was also a period where the board had two members appointed by a Republican president and one member appointed by a Democratic president. And by tradition, the board adheres to a three-vote requirement to overturn any of its own precedent. And if you have, you know, two members who view the act one way and two or one member who views it the other, it's very hard to develop much policy through adjudication. You can't come to a consensus and overturn any prior precedent. And then there's the last problem that the board has had developing policy through this arena has been resistance in the courts. We've seen a lot of pushback to some recent precedents at the appellate level. So that may be pushing the board toward more adjudication. Another reason is that the regulated community has started to call on the board to engage in more rulemaking. There were a few petitions filed by some employer and industry organizations earlier this year, some organizations representing workers, and the causes are, you know, multiple, one of which could be a desire for more certainty and less gyration between administrations. There's some thought their rules might be more durable. And, you know, there might be some frustration with the inability to change policy in the more traditional ways. And the third, which I'll do very quickly because I think the panel is going to have a lot to say about this, is there's a recent decision in the Sixth Circuit, Brown-Forman, which involved the board's ability to make sort of these broad policy announcements in adjudication. We'll talk more about that decision later, but it could potentially rein in a little bit of the board's ability to develop labor policy sort of divorced from any particular issue in a case. So all of that could be pushing us toward a a world where we're doing more rulemaking. But I think that's enough from me. What I would like to do is turn to the panel. And let's start from the premise that I started with, which is that the board historically has been hesitant to engage in rulemaking. Brian, let me start with you. Where does that come from? Why has the board historically been more interested in developing policy through adjudication than rulemaking?
I kind of think there's two basic sources for that reluctance. I think the first is just the architecture of the statute itself, which is, you know, it essentially creates its own internal court system with a trial court and an appellate court. And secondly, there's kind of a history that it's an agency that's been told repeatedly that it has some special expertise with respect to labor relations. And it up until fairly recently anyway, has had a pretty good track record of deference by reviewing courts where, you know, by virtue of its expertise. Right. So I think that the combination of those two factors, it's almost gotten into the bloodstream of the agency, this notion of almost unassailable independence in this particular area, almost to the point sometimes you get the sense of an institutional entitlement to make the final determination on many of these issues. So I think that, you know, it sometimes grates the board enough that they have to submit to appellate review under the statute. I think when they engage in rulemaking, there's added layers to that. You know, now they have to take into account the views of the public. They're subject to the Congressional Review Act, so they're going to have to take into account how Congress may view whatever their rulemaking is. And, you know, it's not only the public and the Congress, but also the courts are going to weigh in on the rulemaking, too. So they're looking at three areas of review when the statute only has one. And I think for an agency that has this, you know, that has been inculcated with the notion of independence, that's been a tough pill to swallow. That's, I think, one of the fundamental reasons why.
No, that's a really great response, Professor Stryker. I mean, does that resonate with you? Do you think this is a issue of the board's, you know, desire for independence in developing policy? And I know you've written a great deal about the board and rulemaking, and I won't characterize your position, but I think you've at least in the past said that the board should be doing more rulemaking, and I'm curious to see whether you still think that's the case.
I'm a qualified advocate of rulemaking for the NLRB. You know, the fundamental problem with the use of adjudication is that there's no predictability. The administration changes and we're 180 degrees. You know, I do a labor law casebook and it's a real burden on me. I got to change this book every 4 years. And that's just a joke, by the way. But it breeds a kind of lack of respect for the board, in my view. Client goes to you, well, that's what the board said 4 years ago, but let's fight it now. And it's hard to say, well, okay, let's fight it now because the board may change its mind. So I think this breeds a form of disrespect for what the board does. And I think it filters into the courts. You know, even during a period of Chevron deference, the board had problems in many of these cases with the circuit courts. And I think now, in the era of Loper-Bright, which overturned Chevron, the board better have good reasons for what it's doing besides its reading of the statute. Because its reading of the statute, the court has said in Loper-Bright, that's for the courts to ultimately decide. They need to have good policy reasons for what they're doing. So I think rulemaking provides a vehicle for that. Now, let me make two cautionary notes. With the decline of the judicial filibuster, we now have the ability to, essentially, I've written about this, pick your own district judge. So that makes it easier to seek to invalidate a rule. And that's a problem. You can also try to pick your court of appeals a little harder. So that's a problem for me, the ease with which you can challenge rulemaking that we should discuss. And I think that comes from the fact that we now have district judges all over the country, many of whom are partisans. And you can essentially, if you pick the right region, you can get an outcome. If you go to Massachusetts, for example, you can be certain that they're all Democrats and they're all anti the current administration. Virtual certainty. And that's true of a number of places. And I think the Republicans have similar favored venues. So that's a problem. The second problem is I don't think the board has used rulemaking in a way that helps them helps it improve its decision making. So if we're going to have a rule, I don't know, let's say a rule dealing with access to email in the factories, I'd like to know what the actual impact that's going to be across a range of industrial establishments. And I think the board's rule should be asking for that kind of information. That will help it, by the way, in judicial review, because then the basis for the board's rule will not be, we feel this is the right reading of the statute, but we've actually canvassed the regulated industry, and we think this is what's going to make sense. So I would like to see a change, and I think Loper Bright, ironically, makes that possible. If, in fact, the board wants to be affirmed, they will need to have a basis for their decisions going beyond their feeling that this is the best reading of the statute.
Now, that's enlightening, I think, sort of spells out legal and practical implications. But, Brian, I'm curious about your experience on the board itself. Aside from, the relative weights of, from a policy standpoint, how you develop new rules, are there practical barriers to rulemaking? We've heard sometimes statements like that the board doesn't have the institutional experience or it's a resources question. What's your view on that? Is this practically something that the board could do if it wanted to?
Well, I think that there definitely are resource issues. The process is labor intensive to comply with the requirements of the APA, because it requires, among other things, a response to any substantive comments. So it does take an awful lot of staff time. That's for sure. And I think it takes more because there really isn't a lot of experience with it amongst any of the staff. I mean, the board's only engaged in rulemaking a handful of times, so there really isn't any institutional knowledge about how to do it efficiently and do it the right way. The track record has, with what the little that they've done, has not been outstanding either. I mean, the 87 healthcare unit determination rulemaking has kind of stood the test of time somewhat. But, you look at there have been some real, missteps in you think back in 2011 when I was on the board and the majority then promulgated the notice posting rule. I mean, that was struck down. You also, I think the other practical consideration is not only is it time intensive, but it's also an elongated process as compared to case adjudication. If you look, the impetus to finally get a rule regarding the board's representation case procedures, probably from inception to it finally being in place for the first time, was close to 5 years. And it went from 2010 to 2015. And I think that that is a consideration that, from a practical perspective, that makes the board somewhat hesitant, both the time and the lack of manpower or expertise or familiarity with the statute. I mean, one of the requirements usually in a rulemaking, not so much with the board, but I can see how it in certain instances it applies, as an economic analysis. economists. And yet by statute, the board can't employ an economist. So, I mean, that's just a kind of an indicator of the lack of bench strength, really, in terms of doing rulemaking. I mean, the staffs for most board members are very bright people, but their training is more in the area of acting like a law clerk to an appellate judge, not to doing drafting rules under the APA.
That makes a whole lot of sense. I'm going to introduce our other panelists and throw it to him. I think, Marvin, I think you're on now. Can you hear us?
I'm here. I apologize. I'm up in Montana, and I did not know that we were going to be stuck in a no signal zone. So I apologize profusely, but I'm very excited to be part of this conversation. I would just say, Brian, who's a very good friend, I guess I would disagree a little with what you're saying. I mean, we issued an unprecedented number of rules during the previous Trump administration. And I would say we, as part of that, we made a large effort to train staff and make it more of a streamlined process at the board. And it was interesting, Phil Miskimara, who is not a fan of rulemaking at the board, one of the things that he said when we were at the conference this weekend was he had done a study, I guess, when he was there, that the time spent on rulemaking is no greater than the time spent on significant decisions coming out of the board. And I think that in some ways, it's a perception that rulemaking is so much more time consuming than a rule, because I think you and I would talk about, you know, the hours deliberating on significant decisions. And I would just say one of the other things that was commented at the board at the meeting this week was, well, but employees are waiting for those decisions. And I think it's an interesting point, only in that the board could issue decisions applying existing precedent and work on rulemakings at the same time so that justice is not delayed. So rulemaking, I think, could be done in conjunction with the adjudicatory function and not hold the cases unnecessarily. So the parties get finality while the rulemaking is in the process of changing the law, and then allowing those individuals to participate. Professor Estreicher, I think you raise an interesting point with regards to, you know, participation in the rule. I mean, the board can ask for whatever participation it wants, but it's limited by how much the parties choose to participate.
Right.
I mean, they can't force the community to, you know, provide information regarding, you know, how it's going to affect manufacturing. And it's why often I have gone before people and said, look, the rule is only as good as the participation from the community. So if you participate, you're going to be far better off with your final rule, which is, I think, what the APA contemplates. So, you know, when you have robust comments covering a large number of issues from a diverse group, that's where you end up with the best rules. So I'm looking forward to this discussion. I'm sorry for sort of jumping in there. And Alex, I'm sure you were like, Marvin's just chomping at the bit. So,
Marvin, I agree with you, but we can solicit information. Other agencies do this, in which we solicit the information that we need. Now, they're not required to provide it, but they do want the position to be sustained. So I think we could be a little more directed. It makes no sense to ask comments on the legal viability of the rule. The board members can do that on their own with their staff. They should be focusing on the practical consequences of the various approaches, in my view.
Well, and let me just say, the board has done such. I mean, when we were on the board, we asked the community charter schools to start providing information. How does the law affect you? What is the effect on unionization? Ask broad questions. The problem was no one submitted comments or submitted briefs in response to the invitation to file briefs. So my only point is that you can ask, but there's never assurances that you're going to get it, which is why the rules are only as good as the parties that participate.
Totally.
And I only make one other comment, because it kept being thrown at me at the conference this week, which I do think is a valid one. which is the time spent on the rule and all of the work that goes into it. The fact that it can be overturned by one court is I think, actually one of the bigger deterrents to rulemaking from the board's perspective, is that non-acquiescence. If one court strikes it down, the board continues to apply their precedent regardless. That same ability does not exist with regards to rulemaking when a rule is vacated.
It's a very good point. The point I made earlier, we have a different caliber of district court judges out there.
Yeah, no, this is a great discussion. I do want to give Brian a chance to respond to the question about resources and time investment. Do you have a different view?
I think that we're all either the victims or beneficiaries of our own experience, and Marvin's experience, I think, on the board is distinctly different from mine. I mean, I know that the board in the 2011 our case rulemaking was consumed for it took enormous amounts of staff time, and I think in part it kind of depends upon the breadth of the rule. I mean, that was an all-encompassing rule about which we received tons and tons of comment. To the extent that there wasn't comment on some of the stuff during Marvin's term may be a function of the fact that the rules in those instances were somewhat narrower. I don't know the reason for that, but I think that our experiences are simply different.
And I agree completely with that, Brian. And I think that and I think particularly in your time, rulemaking was not used ever really at the board. It had been decades since rulemaking had been used at all, which is why
2011 was the first time since the healthcare rules in 87. So that's true.
And that's exactly right. And it's this product of the circumstances where it's so hard to get people to shift positions when it's never been used. And I will tell you, whole candidly, there was tons of resistance to rulemaking at the board, even when we were there. And it was the decision of John and I to really make them flex that muscle. You know, it was the first opportunity to get us in the gym working on rulemaking, and it was not an easy thing to push. And I think it's reflected in, Jim Murphy, who's the new chairman, has, and I think Prouty and others have said openly, they hate rulemaking. And I think, Brian, to your point, that's exactly right, because that's not what they did when they were there. And that's not what they see the board's job as is, we're an adjudicatory agency.
So this is a great exchange, and we've been talking naturally a lot about process. That's mainly what the discussion is about. But I do want to maybe a little more concrete and talk a little bit about substance. Assuming the board were to do more rulemaking, are there areas that would be particularly fruitful for rulemaking that would be particularly suited to it? And Marvin, I'm sorry to go back to you, but I'm going to start with you because I know you've written some on this. What are areas the board could focus on if it did move in this direction for rulemaking?
Well, I think one of the ones that Brian pointed out is right on the money is
you're breaking up.
That all makes sense through. Oh, I'm sorry.
Marvin, you're breaking up now. Try again now.
Okay. So I think one of the things that Brian mentioned was the rulemaking on election procedures. I think a universal approach to the election procedures at the NLRA is essential. And I do think rulemaking there is particularly well suited, right? Because it's an opportunity to use one document to lay out the procedures uniformly rather than looking through adjudication and setting up procedures piecemeal. So I think that is the one that makes sense. I think, and it makes sense to most people thinking about the NLRA. I think blocking charges, though, is that it should be used broadly in considering the entirety of the process, not merely the sections you want to deal with. Blocking charges is one of those things that I think has, you know, the board has done quite badly, myself included, in trying to deal with those issues. I think the other areas that the board should consider, and, you know, and again, this is me advocating for rulemaking more than anything else, is cases of new law. I think CEMEX was a great example of it. I think the Sixth Circuit rightly jumped upon it as this is a huge change that actually has nothing to do with the facts of the case, which is why I argued quite extensively that it was dicta. And if you're going to make that big change, there's value in getting the parties and the community involved in determining what the best way to do it is. And, you know, I think in the end of the day, those broad pronouncements by the board benefit from rulemaking in that instead of 10 years trying to interpret a single case in which exceptions are filed, in which subsequent cases are filed with the same or similar fact patterns, rulemaking provides that opportunity to, you obviously can't guess every fact pattern, but it offers an opportunity to address multiple fact patterns and build a robust area of the law in one document rather than just applying it to the existing question or the existing facts of that single case, which I think is helpful and is important to providing that kind of guidance to the entire community. So I think any big changes in law benefit from rulemaking.
Let me put that same question to Professor Stryker. Professor Stryker, do you agree with that, or are there other areas that you would want to see the board focus on substantively for rulemaking?
I agree with what Marvin said. I mean, when you're applying the act to a group of employees like university employees, I think that'd be another area for rulemaking. If we make it all turn on a statutory definition, the courts have gotten the message from Loper-Bright that that's their call. The more our policy is based on facts that we are elucidating from the rulemaking process, the more sustainable will be the board's position. And so, you know, universities are structured in different ways. I was involved as an expert witness in Yale, having a unit of, the union was proposing a unit of the sociology department, the literature department. I mean, you know, it didn't make any sense given the structure of Yale. And I think that's an area too, not so much on whether they're employees or not, but how does the structure of the university change what the underlying rule should be? But I agree with Marvin on election procedures. The blocking charge policy is, in my view, unfounded and creates more problems than it's worth. It explains a large part of the delay between the filing for an election, the holding of an election, and it's the tail that wags the dog for NLRB representation procedures. And there may be other areas as well. I need to think more concretely about it. But again, I think the board has to readjust itself. Otherwise, the courts of appeals are going to say, gee whiz, you know, that's their view of the law. Our view of the law is different. And the Supreme Court said it's our view of the law that counts. The doctrine of deference that was out there has been substantially diminished. So I don't think it's going to help us that much going forward. So the more that our rules are based on information that we've collected, and I think if we make this clear to the regulated industry, we'll get more response than perhaps we've gotten in the past. So it's in the interest of some of these folks to have the board's position sustained.
Yeah, Alex, I just quickly add, I agree with everything that Sam and Marvin have said. And I think clearly that procedural stuff lends itself much more readily to the rulemaking process. And, you know, just in the blocking charge area, why don't we simply have a rule that says in all cases, we simply vote and impound, period.
I agree. Vote and impound. And tell us what the practical consequences are.
Yeah. And you know, take public comment on that. I'm not sure why that, you know, what the objection to that would be. But, you know, just across the board, that eliminates a lot of stuff. In the substantive area, let me just offer one suggestion. I mean, when I was on the board, I thought we consumed an inordinate amount of time fly-specking people's personnel policies, right? I think that a rule, suppose you had a rule that said if you publish a disclaimer of some kind in your personnel policy handbook, that's sufficient to create a rebuttable presumption that even if you're wrong on a word or it could be interpreted a different way. I mean, you know, this kind of soothsaying that the board engaged in with respect to how employees would view language in a handbook was always absurd in my view. And if you could correct all that and remove most of that litigation simply by saying, hey, if you put a disclaimer in there, then you're home free.
A disclaimer might not be sufficient, but be very helpful. But we could, if there are things we are clear that should not be in the handbook, we could say that. These things should not be in your handbook. Don't make it a subject of case-by-case adjudication.
Well, and I think Brian and Sam raise a really good point, and I will just add to that with the absurdity of the board, which is the board will not tell you how to change those rules to make them lawful. In fact, the board will just tell you to get rid of them. And I think the point that to be made here is that rulemaking could be used to define what that rule should look like rather than the board just saying, well, your rule is wrong, but I'm not going to tell you why it's wrong.
Yep. That's a great point. I'm going to pivot here, and I mentioned in the opening the Brown-Forman case, and Marvin, you alluded to it as well. So we'll move from should the board be doing rulemaking to whether the board may have to do more rulemaking. And just for the audience's sake, because Brown-Forman was a case involving the car check decision by the board during the last administration. I'll just summarize it very quickly. The takeaway from the case was that the board, if it's going to develop new policy through adjudication, must be drawing its new policy from the facts necessary to decide that case, as opposed to announcing freestanding policy rules effectively as part of a decision without going through the rulemaking process. Now, I'm glossing over some detail, but I want to get each of your take on this case and how it could affect rulemaking going forward. Professor Stryker, I'll start with you. Do you think this decision is going to have a practical effect on the board's approach to policymaking? Is it going to drive more adjudication, or is it just too soon to tell?
I favor what the court did in Brown-Forman, but it's too soon to tell. It ties into what we're saying. If in the new post-Chevron world, if the board is going to say certain things are obligatory on the nation, they have to have a factual, evidential basis for what they are doing. They can't simply say that, you know, we think this decision extends to this new situation. But it's hard to say, you know, there's so many different circuits out there. I think ultimately the Supreme Court is going to have to say something about it. But Brown-Forman can also be distinguished. The court said that it was based on an improper adjudication in CEMEX, because CEMEX did not deal with the underlying facts. So I think, you know, if read properly, Brown-Forman should put a halt, as it were, or at least a yellow light on what the board generally does, which is they sit around the table on hard cases. It takes a year. I can't believe that adjudication is faster than rulemaking, because in hard cases, it takes a long time to get a board ruling. That ruling, however, has to be based on experience. Otherwise, you will not command the respect of these courts in this post-Chevron world.
Brian, let me ask you, do you agree with that? Did the court in Brown-Forman get it right? And is that going to affect how the board calculates whether to use rulemaking and adjudication going forward?
I think they did get it right. And I think that, you know, the position is well taken. What happens with it, I agree with Sam completely, is it, you know, I mean, the board has, let's assume, I think there's pending still a motion for reconsideration on Box. So we just have the panel decision at this point. I don't know what's happened with that motion, frankly, but let's assume that it's either denied or the en banc consideration just it reaffirms what the panel decision was. I mean, the board still has the practice of non-acquiescence, where in an effort to create a national labor policy, they agree to disagree with circuit courts all the time. So. You know, that would be the law, at least in the Sixth Circuit, but might not be elsewhere. I think that's why I think it might take some time for this to work its way through the system. And there are, I suppose, nuances to Brown-Forman that would give the board an out in terms of trying to avoid the full impact of the decision. But I think it's pretty clear from the board's reaction to that decision, both, you know, publicly by seeking reconsideration, and even in, you know, certain public statements. I think that the board kind of views that that decision is virtually existential to their way of doing business. So I think just that view reflects the fact that, yeah, if that does finally, when it percolates all the way through, become kind of the standard, then they're going to have to change the way they operate.
And you mentioned the non-acquiescence doctrine. And Marvin, I know you referenced this in your earlier answer. Do you think non-acquiescence, the practice of not following circuit precedent outside that circuit, is going to mute the effect of Brown-Forman, or could you see it getting picked up in other circuits?
I'm sorry, who was that directed at, Brian or me?
That was for you, Marvin. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Sorry. No. I think it will, in the sense that the board will say we're allowed to choose how, and has frequently said we're allowed to choose how we function, and the act allows through adjudication or rulemaking, and we're not going to be bound by that. And if I could just back up on, so I do think the board will not acquiesce to this general statement that they have to do rulemaking. And if I could just back up on Brown-Forman for a second, which is, I think Brown-Forman was sort of like a perfect storm. You do not often see board decisions that are arguably the entirety of the decision is dicta. But CEMEX is that rare decision in which the court, I think, would have been irresponsible to not look at this and say, there's a much longer CEMEX explanation that needs to be understood to fully understand this. But the issue was, you have to file an RM petition if the union asked for recognition. A petition had been filed in CEMEX, so that was not at issue in the case. There were unfair labor practices to justify under CEMEX doing away with your chance to hold an election, but there were the unfair labor practices were so pervasive fell under Gissel.
Hallmark violations.
Yes, hallmark violations fell under Gissel. So so the entirety of the case arguably was dicta. And faced with that culmination, again, I think the court would have been improper for the court to allow it to continue to go forward. It was clearly not within what the decision in CEMEX was not addressing the issues in the case or the facts in the case. So in that backdrop, this was the right decision. I don't know if other courts will adopt it. I don't know if it's the right decision in all circumstances. I do think that there continues to be an area where, if the actual issue is in the case, you should be able to issue it through adjudication. But if you're going to do this broad spectrum change to the law that addresses issues that are not even an issue in the case, I think it's true that that is probably a better that rulemaking is a better mechanism for that. And non-acquiescence shouldn't affect that. I think that that's just good policy and good procedure. And if the board chooses not to acquiesce, I think they're going to invite more of these kind of challenges the further they get from the factual situation that's before them.
And just to pick up on that point, they don't have to, I've written about non-acquiescence a long time ago. They don't have to say they're non-acquiescing. They're just saying, we view this case as limited to its facts, and our facts are different. We're limited to its facts in the way Marvin suggested, that this was the issuance of a general statement that did not deal with the actual facts of the case.
No, that's great. I want to shift now to a different decision. Professor Strecker, you've already referenced it a couple of times. Loper-Bright. So we know that the Supreme Court, a couple of terms ago now, did away with what the former doctrines of deference, overturned the Chevron decision, said that courts ought to be reading the law as the law is written and giving it its best meaning. And that has some pretty clear implications for rulemaking. It could make agencies' job a little more difficult. So, Professor Strecker, can you play that out a little bit? Like, how does Loper-Bright fit into this? Is it going to mute any shift toward rulemaking? Is it just going to, you know, make it harder? Or does the board get some kind of boost in court by virtue of the fact that it's gone through a robust rulemaking process and solicited input from the public? Which way does this cut?
Well, the court had a narrow exception for situations where the act best read delegates interpretive authority to the board. And this brings me back to the use of the word interfere in 8A1, where it's clear Congress abandoned the common law definitions, and there's some room there in interpreting what interfere was, and there are limits to it, as the Supreme Court recognized in Bell Aerospace. So put aside that exception. Outside of that narrow exception, where the best reading of the statute is that there's delegation of interpretive authority to the agency, as I read, and I think they're pretty clear on this, when it comes to interpretation of the organic statute, it is for the courts. And that's why the premise of the board's decision has to be something other than this is our view of the statute. It has to be based on experience, on the reactions they're getting from the regulated industry. And we think this is what's going to work. Otherwise, they are not going to get respect. There's another doctrine called Skidmore respect. And Skidmore respect, you know, is a form of respect. It's not deference, but it's based on the quality of the board's reasoning. So if the board's only reason is this is how we view a prior decision, I think it's not going to do well in the courts in these controversial cases. Most cases are not controversial, but in the controversial cases, they have to premise their decision in other ways. I'm not saying it necessarily requires rulemaking. I think if rulemaking is well done, it can provide some of that information. But and you know, the board can also have people give testimony, even if it's not a rule. They can give a notice that we're going to do this. We want to hear what people have to say. It doesn't formally have to be 553 APA rulemaking, but the point is, the decision has to be based on much more than this is our view of the statute.
Let me ask about a different potential barrier to rulemaking, or at least another layer. Brian, you talked a little bit earlier about all of the different layers of review you may have to go through with rulemaking. And I think it's no secret that this administration has added another, the position of the current administration is that there is no such thing as an independent agency, and that even independent or formerly independent agencies like the board should be submitting their rules to the White House for review before publishing. Do you think that is going to have any downward pressure on any potential shift to rulemaking? Is that going to dissuade the folks in the agency? Because look, they don't have to do that for adjudication. Is that going to affect the calculus?
Yeah, well, I think it's going to depend upon the political or policy alignments. I mean, I think when you have a situation where you have a board majority that's kind of politically or philosophically aligned with an administration, there's going to be less hesitancy to send a rule that they construct to OIRA for review and a blessing for the White House. I think their views may be more aligned. I think conversely, if you have a misalignment between, which happens, because of the way vacancies are filled on the board, if you have a misalignment between the kind of majority view in a particular area on the board and the White House, I think that's going to be a distinct disincentive to proceeding by rulemaking. I think, unfortunately, it may depend largely on the politics of the situation.
Yeah, on the politics point, let me ask, and I'll go to you on this one, Marvin. Is it possible that the politics could affect whether, even if this administration, because I think you mentioned before, the current chair has said he's not a particular fan of rulemaking, but could that influence who is appointed to the board? Could a philosophy toward rulemaking or toward adjudication affect future nominees and the willingness of a future president to put somebody on there who would write rules that would be sent to the White House? Or is this just too in the weeds to affect confirmation and nomination issues?
Well, I think I would think that the White House at a minimum would want to know whether they would, how, given under this new structure, I would think they would want to know would you address new rules? How would you address changes in the law? Would you do it through, I mean, even when we got interviewed, there were questions about, what do you think about invitations to file briefs? What do you think about this? Should you file invitation to file briefs in, should you have an invitation to file briefs in any change in precedent? So I think it's already sort of built in that they would want to know what procedures you are going to apply if you are a board member joining the board. And I do think all of that is put into the calculus of determining whether you would want the person at the board. And I think a White House, whether Republican or Democrat, that wants more control over the board would want greater assurances that they would use rulemaking more often because of the control that the White House can assert over it, and would want assurances that they would abide by because I think there's the other part of this is that you can send it to the White House for approval. But you also, what level of deference are you going to give the White House in that approval process? Or is this going to turn into a fight of, you know, who wins out at the end? So I think that's already built in, but I do think it's going to be something that's going to be contemplated in the future. And particularly, and I would say, I actually think it will be more pronounced in a Democrat administration than in a Republican administration, because I don't think that Republican administrations are spending the time digging into the minutiae of the NLRA to the same extent that you see during a Democrat administration, who comes in with very specific and minor issues that they want dealt with. Whereas in general, I think on the Republican side, you pick the people that you think are going to do a good job and that are aligned on a philosophical perspective, but you have other things that are, you know, your primary concern. So I actually, you know, when's the last time you saw a Republican? I mean, you've never seen a Republican president go out on the line and picket with or strike with employees. But you see that in Democrat administrations, which I think is sort of shows a significant difference in the interest and control over the board itself.
Alex, may I introduce another point? I agree with everything Marvin said. I wrote a brief on this, and I just wrote a piece in Regulatory Review. I think if there's any hope in limiting Trump versus Slaughter, which is the decision that says pretty much the independent agencies are gone, and that's for the board to remain an adjudicative agency, the more it engages in rulemaking, the more likely it is it has to be under the president's control. And my problem with adjudication, where the president can fire the adjudicators, is it really cuts a hole into the integrity of adjudications. I know there's a policy dimension to adjudication, but I think that's, if the board wants to retain, this is something Roger King and I have written about, If the board wants to retain its role as an adjudicative agency, and I think that's important, notwithstanding the need for rulemaking in certain areas, I think it has to make certain structural changes to survive Trump versus Slaughter. So that's just another point of view, because I think it's unclear at this point to what extent Trump versus Slaughter applies to purely adjudicatory agencies. The FTC in Trump versus Slaughter was not a purely adjudicatory agency. It was in 1935, but it wasn't today. And the board largely is adjudicative, but you know, there are things that can take rulemaking away from the board, put it in charge of the Department of Labor or whatever, as is done with Oshrick. So this is another point of view on this issue, and it argues for less rulemaking and more adjudication.
That's a good, I've never heard, or that's the first time I've heard that, you know, that point about purely adjudicatory bodies and Slaughter. It's a great point.
I'll send you our writings on this.
Excellent. Let me close up, because I think we're coming up against the hour, and the panel largely, at least as I've been hearing, is mildly positive on more rulemaking at the board. But Brian, let me ask you to bring us home. Are there downsides that we should be thinking about if the board were to emphasize rulemaking going forward? Are there potential, you know, negatives to the direction of board policy if we were to follow that process more often?
Well, I think that, you know, I guess it always depends upon what one's viewpoint is, but I think that if you have a particular view about what the appropriate policy is, then I think that, you know, one of the benefits of rulemaking, of course, is that theoretically anyway, you have more predictability and more stability. The problem always is if that stability and predictability is with respect to a policy that you might not like, that you have a contrary view to, so that it lacks, you know, what some people call adjudicatory gyrations. Other people call agility, you know. So that's one potential rulemaking, and I think that this may be where Marvin and I have a slight disagreement. I do think that it is conceivable anyway that an emphasis on rulemaking will at particularly at present staffing levels is going to slow slow the adjudicatory process, which is already unconscionably slow. I think those two are legitimate second thoughts about things before one rushes headlong into that as the exclusive way of the board functioning.
That's terrific. Well, we are at the top of the hour. I'll toss this back over to Alex from FedSoc, but I want to thank our fantastic panel. That was a great discussion. I learned a lot. So thank you all for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank our entire panel for sharing their time and expertise with us. And I want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.